This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We are ready to discuss the important events of this week with our panel of trumpet writers here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good afternoon.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And we also have live and in person here in Edmond, Brent Nachtigall.
Yep. Very excited to be here with you.
Great to have you. And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Not sure why they didn't invite me, but thanks to Skype, I'm still not completely left out.
We're glad to have you too, Richard. But we're not going to start with you, as we often do. It has been a wild week in American politics. The battle for power between the American president and his detractors and enemies who are working to take the country in a very different direction rises to new levels every week. But this week was especially rancorous. Later in the program, we're going to talk about the circus going on in the Supreme Court nomination hearings, but we'll start with this unprecedented op-ed article published in the New York Times by someone within the president's administration who calls himself or herself part of, quote, the resistance. For this story, we'll turn to a very deep-voiced Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the New York Times published this op-ed on Wednesday. It's titled, "I Am Part of the Resistance Inside the Trump Administration." And it's by an anonymous White House official who's claiming to be a senior member of the Trump administration. The New York Times claims to know their identity, obviously, but is keeping it a secret for fear that they may lose their job for what they've written. And understandably so, because they begin off towards the beginning of this op-ed, where the anonymous source writes, "We believe our first duty is to this country, and the president continues to act in a manner that is detrimental to the health of our republic. That is why many Trump appointees have vowed to do what they can to preserve our democratic institutions while thwarting Mr. Trump's more misguided impulses until he's out of office." Then you skip ahead a little bit, and it goes, "From the White House to the executive branch departments and agencies, senior officials will privately admit that their daily disbelief at the commander-in-chief's comments and actions." And so this is someone working inside the Trump administration, claims to be a senior official. Now, there are 377 people working in the office of the White House and roughly 4,000 in the executive branch of the presidency. So you're a senior official amongst 4,000, so that it doesn't really make it easy to narrow down who this is going to be. It's probably not Vice President Mike Pence or anywhere near his seniority.
Yeah, although there are quite a few people who would say that probably the New York Times wouldn't have stuck its neck out to this degree had it not been someone who was fairly high placed within the administration, which seems like a logical conclusion to make.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure. I think generally when people publish anonymous op-eds, they don't intend for them to always be anonymous. It's a theatrical game. It's like at some point it's a political move where they're thinking that Donald Trump's going to come down and you're going to be famous when it finally comes out who this was. So someday we will know who the official is. But it's interesting just because you're going through this op-ed, and it's talking about like this anonymous official and others who are actually part of the Trump administration, part of the White House administration, which would make it likely in a Trump appointee, definitely unelected. The only person elected in the executive branch is Donald Trump himself. But talking about trying to thwart the president's agenda, and they frame this like it's like, well, we're defending American democracy from this unhinged president, which I think, you do well to invest in a dictionary, because that's not what democracy means. Like I said, the only person in the executive branch who anyone voted for was, I guess, Donald Trump and by extension Mike Pence, since they ran on the same ticket. And so you've got this this group of like-minded, unelected bureaucrats who's trying to defend democracy from a guy that 63 million people voted for. So that's not democracy. That's technocracy. No, yeah, there's a number of the president's supporters who've been saying for quite some time that there's this group of unelected bureaucrats, quite a few of them, who they've labeled the deep state, that are trying to undermine the president's agenda. Obviously, the president comes in as the only elected official. He appoints maybe 4,000 people. And then beyond that, there's like 3 million other people who work in offices and executive agencies in the executive branch, and they don't necessarily always change. That top 4,000 people get reappointed every time there's a new election, but the rest of them, they're just kind of always there. And so it makes it hard for a new administration to change the course of the American government, because many of the decisions made by the American government are made by this bureaucracy that many people have called the deep state. Now, the author of this anonymous op-ed takes a little bit of exception with that. This is probably my favorite sentence from the op-ed, where it says, "This isn't the work of the so-called deep state. This is the work of the steady state," which means that while the author does need to invest in a dictionary at some point in the near future, they definitely do have a thesaurus on their desk someplace.
Right.
Because the steady state, deep state, are what conservatives are calling it because it sounds more sinister. Steady state's what liberals are calling it because it sounds more mundane. But at the same time, it's describing the same phenomenon. There is this entrenched network of bureaucrats deep within the American government that are trying to make America follow a steady course towards their end goal. As they see it, without pesky things like elections mucking stuff up.
Yeah, accountability to the electorate.
And so there's been some, I think, like Glenn Greenwald, who's a journalist who's written quite a bit about the deep state and stuff like that. He had made that point, too, that he's actually not a Trump supporter, but he has to admit that just the idea of a shadowy cabal of government agents secretly thwarting the president's agenda to protect democracy is ludicrous. Mm-hmm. That's not democracy. That's government officials running the country with no accountability to the people.
Yeah. Yeah. This really, in so many ways, this New York Times piece reaffirms exactly what Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory has been focusing on for quite some time now, that here Donald Trump came into office and you immediately began to see this war going on between this deep state, as you're calling it, and the man that the people, 63 million Americans, put into that office. And all of this is being exposed in a way that we never would have seen had Hillary Clinton come into power.
Right. Yeah. If Hillary Clinton would have come into power, it would have continued the direction with the Obama administration was taking. And the President Obama just happened to share a common ideology with this deep state bureaucracy. So you didn't notice the conflict so much. They were like working together to grow the size and influence of the American government. Donald Trump comes in with he made his executive order that for every new regulation passed, you have to get rid of two old ones. Mm-hmm. And he did his hiring freeze, and he's wanting to bring back down the book of regulations to 1960s levels. And so all these bureaucrats who make their living telling other people what to do and micromanaging the American nation, they're not thrilled with this whole deregulation, freeze, shrink the size of the government agenda, and are trying to do whatever they can do to either push President Trump out of office or make sure that he doesn't get anything accomplished until they can get someone else elected president.
You know, if you haven't heard it, please go listen to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning. Stephen Flurry ran a montage probably within the first 10 minutes of the program of media hyperventilation over the president, and how I think it was taken over some period, but it was all of these pundits just saying the president is having the worst week of his presidency. He's absolutely going down. This is a crisis for the country, and just like acting like every single thing that happens, every new development, this is the turning point where we're going to see the president fall. And just like everyone is cheering for and rooting for and hoping that this is going to happen, the individual who ran this op-ed, he has plenty of friends at the New York Times and other media outlets that are part of the resistance. And this resistance is very entrenched and it's very aggressive. And you see it playing out day by day, week by week in this country. Go and listen to that, because it really does give you a quite a vivid picture of exactly what Gerald Fleury has been saying about this administration and just how far the leftists in this country have taken it in a direction very different from what the founders ever intended it to be. It's a really quite an eye-opening thing. And I would also encourage you to go online. Andrew is going to have an article on this anonymous New York Times op-ed, confirms deep state is real. It is real, and we've written quite a bit about this over the last few months at The Trumpet. We have this article called Is the Deep State Real? And a couple of articles that were in the July 2018 Trumpet edition and earlier editions this year, definitely worth checking out. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. A couple of stories about Germany now. The first regarding an interesting mission being undertaken by German troops. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
So on August 11th, German soldiers began training the Iraqi army near Baghdad. Initially, there'll be about 400 of them training Iraqi soldiers there. They've got German parliamentary approval for that mission to go up to 800 soldiers. And it's a very interesting mission. For the last few years, they've been training Kurdish forces in the north of Iraq. And by all accounts, they've been doing quite well. They've trained 18,000 of them. They've been equipping them with modern weapons as well. But Baghdad, or the actual Iraqi army, has kind of been complaining, you know, we want some of this training as well. But what's interesting is Germany began training these Kurdish forces to fight the Islamic State. The war against the Islamic State is pretty much over now in terms of at least Iraq. And yet Germany is now expanding their training mission, moving south and working with the Iraqi army. The other thing that's interesting is NATO has a training mission in Iraq already. And this NATO mission is quite keen for Germany to cooperate with them and to work together with them. However, Germany's been very dogmatic that they're not going to get involved with the NATO training mission. They want to go it alone. And it's very rare for Germany to have some kind of military mission where it's not going along with just like NATO or the European Union and it's acting solo. So quite a few unusual things about this mission that just got underway last month.
So what is it that the fact that it's very unusual certainly is of interest, but the fact that it's taking place in Iraq, just give us the context of what it is about this that makes it so intriguing from a prophetic perspective.
Right. So the first hint of this comes from the fact that the German military is emphatic that they also don't want to be training certain parts of the Iraqi army or the militia. You know, they do not want to be training any Shiite militia, that some of which are being brought into the Iraqi army, but they're saying, you know, we're not going to work with those parts. They have links to Iran. We don't want to be training any soldiers that have links to Iran. So you start to get the picture that they're working in Iraq against Iran. At the very least, having these 400 soldiers stationed there will enable them to keep a very close eye on what Iran is doing, and especially what Iran is doing within the Iraqi army. They're much closer now to the center of power there in Baghdad. But it wouldn't surprise me if they want to go further than that, and they hope to kind of build up the Iraqi army so that it can be its own independent force and not have to keep relying on Iran in the same way that it had to in the crisis with the Islamic State, where they just had to pretty much give free rein to Iran to go and come in and take care of the problem.
So it's a certain amount of recognizing just how deeply entrenched in Iraq Iran really is, and Germany essentially trying to provide some kind of a counterweight to that.
Some kind of a counterweight, or at the very least, keep tabs on it, which we've been watching for this for quite some time, this strategy that Germany has of opposing Iran in all of the different places that it can. The Bible has this term where it talks about, in Daniel 11, Germany coming against radical Islam led by Iran like a whirlwind. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has a booklet on Germany's secret strategy to destroy Iran that talks about how, well, if you look into what the Hebrew word for whirlwind means, it implies surrounding, that they've surrounded Iran, that they attack them from all sides. And he said, well, this is a strategy Germany's working on right now. And you can see that in quite a lot of places. You know, Britain, who's meant to be this staunch ally of America, has left Afghanistan and left Afghanistan years ago, despite being, I think, the second biggest, or at least definitely up there in terms of contribution of troops. Germany's still there, and in fact, it's one of their major Middle Eastern missions. You've got Germany heavily involved in North Africa to counter terrorists, where they've got a strong presence in Mali, where they're working to create this African force funded by Germany to a large part, and also France, to fight terrorism there. You know, working against terrorism, looking at getting involved in Libya to try and fight terrorism, trying to build links with Egypt because they want to maintain Egypt as independent with Iran. And so they're doing things to work with the Egyptian Navy. Just over the last few weeks, Angela Merkel was in Azerbaijan, right there on Iran's northern border. And she was trying to open up and do weapons deals with Azerbaijan, despite the fact that Azerbaijan is under an arms embargo from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And then you've got all of Germany's dealings. I'm sure Brent will talk a bit more about that with Turkey, with Saudi Arabia, where they're doing arms deals. So you look at this whole picture and you see, yeah, Germany quietly working away there with forming links between militaries, with training missions, funding, with arms sales, and all of these locations all around Iran. And so getting involved in Iraq fits right in with that. So they got involved with the Peshmerga, those Kurdish forces, a few years ago. Now they're getting more deeply involved with the Iraqi military. You put that in context with the whole rest of their plan, and you see just more of this whirlwind strategy of opposing Iran, surrounding Iran in everywhere that they can.
Yeah, that is quite extraordinary, and to point to listeners back to that article by Gerald Flurry about, or I guess it's really a booklet that we have, Germany's Secret Strategy to Destroy Iran. It's exposed a bit in this particular mission, as you brought out the fact that they're not participating in the NATO mission down there, that they've distanced themselves, and yet they're doing what supposedly it seems like on the surface is doubling up the work. Well, we're going to do this job, but just apart from NATO, even though, say, on the surface, the designs would seem to be exactly the same.
Right. And you remember, Germany opposed the Iraq invasion initially, and you have to wonder whether some in Germany saw the same thing that we did, that if you're going to take out Saddam Hussein and Iraq, then you're very likely going to be handing Iraq over to Iran. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't take part in that mission. And so, yeah, I think they probably feel that NATO is a little too lenient on Iran, or at least on these Iranian forces there within Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Well, quite a lengthy, excellent article by Josue Michels up on the website today, What is Germany Doing in Iraq? And that points to that booklet as well. Check that out by Gerald Flurry, Germany's Secret Strategy to Destroy Iran, and then this article on the website now. We really appreciate you bringing that to us, Richard. And now to Germany's relationship with Turkey. Richard mentioned there another relationship with strong prophetic significance. And this week, a meeting between the two states on a couple of very sensitive matters. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, the last major battle front in the Syrian civil war is taking place, began this week. This province is right on Turkey's border, Idlib province. It's got about 3 million civilians. And Turkey and Germany met together, the foreign minister of Turkey flying down there Wednesday, Thursday, to discuss the strategy that Turkey would employ, I believe, in trying to negotiate some settlement with the regime forces, Syria's regime forces. This is really substantial, really significant, because today Erdogan is meeting with Putin in Tehran, and they are talking about this offensive, all of them together on both different sides. Turkey really has been supporting rebels in Idlib province. They have 12 observation posts right there. Turkish troops are in Syria in this province, and they're trying to figure out a way that their forces don't come up against one another, and they're trying to figure out a way of not sending 1 million of the 3 million civilians in this territory into Europe. Mm-hmm. And so you had Germany, prior to this main meeting between Erdogan, Putin, and Rouhani, you had Germany in Turkey's ear saying that what they would like them to achieve from it. So this is really significant when you think about world leaders that are active today, what the world is focused on. Angela Merkel received a call from Mr. Trump earlier this week about trying to, you know, that's kind of the way that the U.S. is participating in this, even, is through Germany's mediation. And then Turkey is there representing the European position in Iran. So we know of the huge significance that the fighting in Syria has had on German security as far as the government goes, with over a million refugees flowing into Germany, just busting up the post-World War II norms. Richard talked about that last week, a migrant, you know, killing somebody and seeing what happens from that. And so they can't have more migrants. And so Germany said that they're willing to give Turkey a bunch more money to try and keep them south of the border. But it's, you just have this huge confluence of factors that is bringing Turkey and Germany closer to ensure that they don't get this refugee crisis continuing. Now, this, people should realize also, while I keep on talking, is that this battle taking place is the worst battle that we've seen in the prior 6 years of the Syrian civil war. All the fighters, all the rebel fighters from the different patches of Syria have been allowed on purpose to retreat back to Idlib, this province. And so you have estimates of 20 to 80,000 fighters that are willing to give their lives up, it seems, to fight against the Assad regime, that would fight to the death if they had to. And so that's why we have this meeting. Russia doesn't want to have to come up against Turkey. They don't want, it seems, to send all these migrants up, or at least they don't mind the threat of that. And so this has the potential to blow up majorly. Already Russia is bombing them. Already Syrian troops are readying their ground forces to attack. And so what's interesting in this is that Germany is involved through Turkey to try and stop it from happening or limit the impact.
You're working on a major article for the next print edition about Syria and trying to just bring some clarity to all of the factors at play here. And we see all of them in action here, with Germany trying to limit the migration, Turkey being involved, and Turkey and Germany working in cahoots with one another in order to come to some common ground. You see Russia in the picture, and here Russia continues to work on side with Iran, despite what we've been talking about for quite a while now, where you see the separation between these two and their interests being at odds with one another. What do you make of all of it?
Well, I mean, thankfully we have biblical prophecy that is showing us where this will end. And so we see the end result, and then we try and figure out how we could get there from what we see geopolitically. And all these things are lining up. Germany's relationship with Turkey, we've talked about, that's prophetic, that's going to grow stronger. But it wasn't strong, so there needed to be a common reason for that. And the migration of people, refugees out of Syria, has brought them together. Then we see Russia playing this middle role, which isn't really featured in biblical prophecy inside Syria. And so we view them as being a temporary thing inside Syria, but maybe a means to an end to remove Iran, as even we've talked about. And the article will go into ways that Russia is actually doing that. Mm-hmm. The end result, again, is going to see Iran out of influence with the Syrian regime. It might be temporarily Russia that looks to be the dominant power there for a while, but with no money in their coffers, they are
going to have to reach out to Europe to fund the reconstruction. And if Europe gives up money to something, they also want a lot in return. And so we can see how, as this gets towards the end of the Syrian civil war in this major final battle, that there are going to be deals being worked out, particularly with Russia and Europe, Turkey being potentially being in the middle there, which we can see a path to how Iran will exit Syria. And this article is going to make that plain. Also, the Trumpet Daily radio show, I'm doing that on Monday. And so that'll kind of be a precursor to the article as well, that if people want to really see how this fits Bible prophecy, they can listen to that and also wait for that article. And really just don't be turned off by Syria, because this is one arena where we separate ourselves from every commentator out there that has said that Iran cannot will always be allied with the Syrian regime. We've said from the start that is not going to happen. And so as we see that take shape, that's exciting. That's amazing. It's a wonderful proof of biblical prophecy for people listening.
Very good. We'll look forward to hearing that program, and we'll watch for that article as well. That'll be a few weeks away, but we do appreciate you bringing that to us, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Speaking of Iran, a decision to undermine America's sanctions against Iran, taken this week by India, could really be a troubling development. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was on Monday that India's central government told state oil refiners to continue imports of Iranian oil despite U.S. sanctions that are supposed to prevent that very thing. So it's under a special agreement that makes Iran provide the shipping and the insurance for the oil, because all the usual shippers and insurers are unwilling to enable these transactions just because of the sanctions that U.S. President Donald Trump recently reinstated on Iran after he withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 nuclear agreement between Iran and six other countries. So Iran's providing the shipping and the insurance, and the Indian government is telling its refiners to basically ignore those sanctions and to just continue bringing this oil, Iranian crude and condensate, into India. And it's interesting that this decision by the Indian government also closely follows a Chinese decision to do the same thing. China's also bringing Iranian oil into China there. And India and China are the two biggest importers of Iranian oil. So these decisions really throw a lifeline to the Iranian oil-dominated economy. There's a quote here from Reuters that says, "The moves by the two top buyers of Iranian crude indicate that the Islamic Republic may not be fully cut off from global oil markets from November, when U.S. sanctions against Tehran's petroleum sector are due to start." So this decision could really just weaken the U.S.-led efforts to put pressure on Iran. And with China, we would fully expect this. You know, they work at every opportunity to oppose U.S. interests and to help our enemies, even if it's only for the sake of helping our enemies. But with India, though, which the U.S. designates a major defense partner, this is a worrying move. And I think it really calls the integrity of the U.S.-India relationship into question.
What I think is interesting about this is that early on when these sanctions were announced, India was in discussions with the United States, and the United States was willing to cut India some slack. There are some importers of Iranian oil that could receive a provision that allowed them to more slowly wean themselves off Iranian oil or the need to import that for their own demand. And yet, as he said, this is like totally following what China announced 2 weeks ago. And so just as it's an anti-United States type move to limit what the United States can do to pressure Iran, it's also just really showing, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if China was like, "Hey, India, this is what we're doing. You can do it well as well. It's really going to strengthen both of us." But this is a slap in the face to the U.S. because India was going to, it looks like, receive those provisions to allow them to import oil for a little bit longer than the rest of the world.
Yeah, so the fact that it's doing this really does seem to be a deliberate move to demonstrate the direction that India is taking, more to a pro-China, pro-Asia posture and away from the United States.
India officially is still hoping that the U.S. will grant it waivers and exemptions. So I don't think that they would hope that it's viewed as a deliberate kind mm-hmm. of a kind of a posturing on their part. But it's hard not to see it that way in some regards, because if they had, like right now, Pompeo is there meeting with Indian officials, and it looks like they may be able to work out something. But the fact that they decided on Monday, days ahead of this visit, to say we're going to green light it, it does show just a bit of less respect for the system, and kind of going through official channels than you would expect from a major partner like India.
So this was not the only deal that India made that was counter to American efforts at putting down sanctions.
That's right, yeah. India's announcement about buying Iranian oil actually came the exact same day that India said it would proceed with a major weapons purchase from Russia, despite a different set of U.S. sanctions that are set up to penalize any nation that buys significant amounts of weapons from Russia. That's the CATSA. We've talked about it on the Trumpet Hour before, the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act. And it specifically says nobody can buy major, do major purchases of Russian weaponry if they want to be able to do business with the U.S. But India said on Monday that despite that, they are giving Russia billions of dollars to buy the S-400 missile system. So these two stories are really parallel in many ways. In both cases, India says it hopes the U.S. might grant it exceptions. And there's a chance that America might do that. But still, though, the fact that India is making these agreements with Iran and with Russia just really shows that it may eventually be willing to end its relationship with Washington in order to better pursue its interests with Russia and Iran and other Asian powers.
Why do you suppose it's willing to take such a risk?
Well, a lot of it may just be strategic. You know, for Iran, It would be very difficult for India to replace the oil supplies that it's getting from Iran with another power. It's quite a lot of oil that they're bringing in there. And then Iran also gives India some opportunities to advance its regional and security goals in ways that America can't do. The biggest example of this right now is the Chabahar port that India is building on Iran's southeastern coast. You know, Pakistan always blocks India out from being able to trade with Afghanistan and other Central Asian markets. But with this port, India is able to bypass Pakistan, and it's able to have easy trade with Iran, Afghanistan, and other Central Asian markets there. The Chabahar port also gives India a means of kind of checking China's investment and military ambitions right next door in the Gwadar port there in Pakistan. So that's really valuable to India. That's Iran. But then with Russia, it's even more valuable to India. India is the world's number one weapons importer. They've spent about $100 billion in the last 10 years bringing weapons into the country. And more than 60% of that comes from Russia. So that's a huge concern for India's military establishment, just to be able to keep those weapons coming in. And unlike the United States, Russia is willing to undertake joint ventures with Indian arms manufacturers. So that really aids India's goal of being able to modernize its domestic weapons production capability.
So cost-benefit analysis for India, it's basically saying, you know, these Asian alliances are more valuable to us.
That's what it looks like. And from a strategic standpoint, they may be right. But I think that in the short term, at least, we will still see India trying to walk the tightrope and still, you know, keep America on side as much as it can.
Well, we have an article up on the website today from Jeremiah. India's deals with Iran and Russia defy U.S. sanctions. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. And that also points to another article, The Other Asian Powerhouse, India, that gives a bigger perspective on what's happening in India from the standpoint of Bible prophecy. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, takeaways from the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, Russia stepping up its war in Ukraine, why Iran is moving its main oil export terminal, and how the city with the most super rich people of any city on earth is no longer New York City. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Well, returning to the lunacy happening in the United States, hearings for the next Supreme Court nominee began this week, and it's as has been the case since Robert Bork's nomination over 30 years ago. It was quite a circus. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, judicial nominations in the United States have been getting even crazier and crazier since the Bork nomination. Judge Brett Kavanaugh is now in his fourth day of confirmation hearings, and it's just kind of like a level of lunacy with if you listen to any of the hearings, just all the noise in the background, because as you mentioned earlier, Judge Robert Bork, I mean, was definitely demonized, but it was mostly in a speech by a senator. Mm. Judge Kavanaugh, that's still the same. He's definitely been demonized in speech by senators, but then there's also like Code Pink and all these other pro-abortion and other social justice agencies like protesting on the floor of the Senate, to where you watch the confirmation hearings. Like in every couple minutes, you'll see like a security officer dragging someone, screaming from the chamber, and just all this noise in the background. You hear all these accusations. I think he's been accused of criminal theft, of being complicit in sexual harassment. It is just really crazy to watch. But getting down into more, I guess, the substance of what they're trying to do is they're obviously the Democrats are against Judge Kavanaugh being appointed to the Supreme Court. And they're trying to find whatever dirt they can find for these confirmation hearings. But it really comes down to is the big thing is his views on abortion. Because at the end of the day, even if every Democrat voted against his confirmation, you only need 51 votes to confirm him. Mm-hmm. And there's 51 Republicans. So mm-hmm. as long as the Republicans, they really think there's two kind of like pro-abortion Republicans who they think may oppose his nomination if he says he'll overturn the Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision that made abortion a constitutional right in every state. So as basically, as long as he can avoid saying, "I would overturn Roe versus Wade," mm-hmm. He'll get the nomination. Mm-hmm. And so that's the strategy behind the confirmation hearings is to get him to say that he would do that. Now, when he was appointed to the Third Circuit Court some years ago under the Bush administration, they asked him the same question, and he said that Roe versus Wade is settled law. Only a Supreme Court justice could overturn it, which is good enough to get appointed to the Third Circuit Court. Now that you're looking to get appointed as a Supreme Court justice, you can't necessarily use that excuse anymore. So it's particularly Senator Dianne Feinstein really grilled him over his views on abortion, and he's really stuck to the state that he said Roe versus Wade, it is judicial precedent, it is settled law. And because the Casey versus Planned Parenthood case in 1992 or 1993 built upon the precedent of Roe versus Wade, he said it's now precedent upon precedent. Mm-hmm. So he's definitely not saying that he wants to overturn it. And he's definitely saying that he does regard it as precedent, which should be good enough to get him confirmed as the Supreme Court justice, despite the protest and the security situations there on the Senate floor.
It strikes me just watching all of this unfold, just how childish the opposition against him is. Here's a man who basically says we don't interpret or we don't legislate from the bench. We just say this is what the law means, and this is and we're judging according to what the law says, and that is somehow considered radical in America today. And all of the people who are opposed and they're concerned over a particular ruling over over abortion. But the fact is that they're willing to do whatever is necessary to try to throw up every obstacle that they possibly can. And it really, to me, it comes back to what we were talking about in the first segment, just how the way that all of this is unfolding is exposing just how radical the left has become in the United States.
Right, because it's an interesting situation right now, because the left, they've lost the presidency, they've lost the Senate, they've lost the House, they've, for all intents and purposes, lost the Supreme Court, lost most state governorships, and so they don't control any of the constitutional branches of government anymore. But they do have great influence with the media and with the bureaucracy in Washington and with like these grassroots protest movements, none of which are constitutionally sanctioned governing bodies, but it's all they've got. So you just have to protest, use deep state operatives or steady state operatives, if I'm being politically correct, to fight against what Congress and the presidency are doing. And just resort to smears or use your control over the media and your control over these protesters on the floors of the Senate to try to like block Supreme Court nominations. Mm. Even though, as you said, the Supreme Court nominee, he's pledged to do nothing except uphold the text of the laws already on the books. Mm-hmm. If you don't like those laws, I mean, you should vote for new laws. But if you've lost the Senate and the House, you can't do that. And so there's no legal way to get your policies enacted.
I think, too, of just how much other countries have to be watching all of this unfolding. I mean, what a week. We were talking earlier about the New York Times and this resistance that's taking place within the administration. You see the way that these hearings of Kavanaugh unfolded, an hour and 15 minutes of just Democrats interrupting the chairman trying to go ahead with these proceedings so that it could just take place, and federal officials having to arrest some 70 people just to quiet things down enough that they could hold the hearings. There's a level of rancor and opposition taking place within the United States government that America's enemies have to be watching and just saying, "Wow, this is terrific theater." Like, they can just sit back, grab a bowl of popcorn and enjoy watching the American government tear itself apart. It's really remarkable to see this taking place. I mean, I think there's the evidence of just how much the curses that are affecting the United States are impairing us and preventing us from being able to move forward just goes greater all the time. And what's going to happen after the next, after November's election? You know, what happens if Republicans lose control of the legislation, and you're going to see just a level of opposition that will increase all the more, calls for impeachment, all of these things that will just bog America's government down all the more. So it's amazing to watch this happening, and we will definitely try to keep everyone abreast of developments as they occur. But to go back and look at Great Again and America Under Attack, those booklets that Gerald Fleury wrote some time ago, I think those just become more relevant all the time. We appreciate that, Andrew. Ukraine's military has been at war for more than 4 years with Russian separatists, and this summer actually has seen an escalation in Russia's aggression in Ukraine. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is your bi-monthly reminder that the war is still going on. But in recent weeks, we've seen some important steps. So probably the biggest is that it seems like Russia has now begun to blockade Ukraine. You may remember a while ago, Jeremiah was talking about this bridge that Russia had built from Crimea to Russia proper over the Kerch Strait. The trouble for Ukraine is that about 80% of their exports go through the Sea of Azov and through the Kerch Strait, so basically under this Russian-built bridge. So now Russia has got this big bridge in place, and they've got all presumably their construction equipment and all of that out the way. They seem to be trying to blockade Ukraine to stop Ukraine from trading, to stop all of this trade coming out, because that, the Sea of Azov, the Kerch Strait, it's a great place for a lot of the raw materials that that Ukraine exports to go out to the rest of the world. At the same time, you're seeing a spike in activity by Russian naval forces over the summer, with more gunboats, corvette submarines harassing Ukrainian ships. They've stopped at least 16 vessels heading for Ukrainian ports over the last few weeks. They've delayed hundreds since April, and that's according to a report from the U.S. State Department. And Ukrainian officials are warning that this could escalate into war. At the same, or I guess war already, but it'd be more outright war. At the same time, you had the leader of the Donetsk People's Republic, this separatist region that Russia, that is full of Russian troops that Russia controls within Ukraine, where the fighting is going on. He was killed very recently. I think this time, about this time last week, by an improvised explosive device. Now, it's not clear who killed him. It could have been Ukraine. It could have been Russia. It could have been some kind of internal conflict within that Russian-controlled area where he was killed by a rival for power. However, Russia is blaming Ukraine and saying that they will take action. At the same time as you've got all of this escalation, you've got Russia and China preparing now for their biggest, for Russia's biggest military drills since the end of the Cold War. They begin on Tuesday. And often Russia uses these drills, or sometimes they use these drills as cover for the beginning of a military operation. Now, it looks some of these drills will be taking place in the Middle East. There's quite a high naval concentration within the Mediterranean to do with these drills. And it very well could, this could be to do with the assault on Idlib that Brent was talking about. One or two experts are also speculating that it could be an excuse for Russia to gear up for an assault on Ukraine. Now, I don't necessarily think that this will break out into hot war, but it definitely shows Russia's pushiness and aggression. They're keeping on going to push Ukraine. In some ways, maybe they'll just keep it as an escalating economic attack, showing Ukraine, look, we can keep being more aggressive. We can keep doing things to hurt you. And the rest of the world doesn't care. Europe's not going to step up sanctions. And if anything, they may roll them back. We're drawing close to Germany. You're on your own. You need to reach an accommodation with us. You need to give us more power there. But this Russian ambition in Ukraine is something to keep watching. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had just a really landmark article on this in March 2014 called "The Ukraine Crisis Was Prophesied." And in that article, he talked about how this shift in Russia from this kind of international joke under Boris Yeltsin to this really pushy Vladimir Putin that's trying to recreate the Soviet Union is something that is prophesied. This turnaround in Russia was forecast. And he himself, Mr. Flurry himself, even said, well, I think will we see Russia start to try and take some of Ukraine? I think we will see that. And that's exactly what we did see. So keep watching that region, because it exposes this rising power in Russia. And that rising power and the effect that it has in Europe is something that is just crucial for plays a central role in Bible prophecy. So read that article, "The Ukraine Crisis Was Prophesied," to understand that prophecy, how it was forecast, and the effects that it's going to have on Europe.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Iran's main oil export terminal has been situated in the Persian Gulf, but Iran announced this week that that terminal will move for interesting strategic reasons. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, you've got this really interesting situation developing where Iran has threatened to close the Straits of Hormuz if the U.S. is effective in its oil sanctions that we referred to earlier, and that would cut off the rest of the oil that comes through the Strait of Hormuz from the Persian Gulf going out into the world oil markets. Again, this is 35% of seaborne oil comes through this narrow strait. And so if Iran was to do that, they would at this point in time also cancel any of their oil shipments out of the strait as well. So they wouldn't be able to deliver any of their own oil. So it seems like they've come up with a solution with, on Tuesday, the president, Hassan Rouhani, announcing that they're going to move their main oil terminal from Kark Island, which is in the Persian Gulf, up to a new port that's just on the other side of the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, which would then allow them to block the Strait of Hormuz without affecting their own oil shipments. And so this is really interesting when we look at it prophetically, because we've talked about Iran's desire to hold the world hostage by stopping oil trade out of the Middle East through the Strait of Hormuz and the other choke points, Bab el-Mandab and also the Suez. But that was always going to come at a hurt to them, because they would, their oil sales would diminish, and that again is 70% of their income, their revenue comes from oil sales. And so how are they going to accomplish this? By, they wouldn't be cutting off their, you know, their own lifeline. So it seems like they've found a solution. Move our port outside the Strait of Hormuz. Then we can take over the Bab el-Mandab and the Suez, because our oil anyway doesn't flow into Europe. Our oil is going east, as we covered before, so they would be preserved in that way. And so just a very interesting development in the Middle East this week.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. If you want more information about that, go back and read Callum Wood's article, Bab el-Mandab, The Gate of Tears, I think is the name of it. We had him on the program on Wednesday talking about just how strategically important that strait is. We appreciate that. One final story, the city with more super rich people than any other city on Earth. It used to be New York City, but no longer. To learn which city took its place and why this is important, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Hong Kong has overtaken New York City to become the city with more super rich people than any other metropolis on the planet. That's according to a new study published on Thursday by the WealthX research firm. And they look at people who are worth $30 million or more. Anyone worth that much, they call an ultra-high net worth individual, which you can affectionately abbreviate as an ennui. And the number of ennuis living in Hong Kong now has risen up to about 10,000 in the last year. So this is significant because New York City has always held the top spot on this list ever since 2011, when WealthX first began this ranking system. But now China's rapid economic growth has boosted the number of ultra-rich in the region and propelled Hong Kong above New York, above London, above LA, Paris, Tokyo, and everywhere else. And, you know, as a country, the U.S. is still at the top of the list with a higher number of ennuis living in the country as a whole. But China is rapidly catching up even on that metric. And Hong Kong is a major part of closing this gap. But this is really significant because, of course, Hong Kong 20 years ago was part of the British Empire. It was 21 years ago that the UK handed Hong Kong over to China. And with that historic handover, Chinese power greatly multiplied. And the final act was performed in the closure of the British Empire. And in terms of Bible prophecy, that transfer was really significant because Hong Kong is one of the sea gates that really allowed, well, it allows access and even control of the South China Sea there. And it was one of many sea gates that Britain controlled during its empire era, and that didn't happen by accident. You know, Genesis 22 records God making some amazing promises to the patriarch Abraham. One of those says that his descendants, mainly the British and American people, would possess the gates of their enemies. And that's talking about sea gates, such as Hong Kong, that allowed Britain to control the seas for so long. But then the Bible also prophesied that the British people would later lose those sea gates and see them handed back over to their enemies. Deuteronomy 28:52 says that. So when Hong Kong was handed over to China, it was really a fulfillment of that prophecy. And today we see just how wealthy Hong Kong is becoming and how strategically valuable it remains. And that's just a huge part of China's rise and the decline of the English-speaking nations. So we have an article in the show notes called Hong Kong Handover 20 Years On, and it really dives into these prophecies and explains the biblically prophetic significance of it.
All right, very good. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on today's program. You can email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
No worries.
Honor to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Glad I could join you.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of David Zucker. Quit now, you'll never make it. If you disregard this advice, you'll be halfway there. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.